business before the United States Airport Court of Criminal Appeals. Draw near, for the court is now in session.
Please be
seated. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. This court is called to order. Court calls the case of United States versus Major Daniel O'Connor, ACM number 38420. Are both sides ready to present argument?
Counsel for the appellate is ready, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Wells, I understand you want to reserve 10 minutes. Is that correct?
That would be correct, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Thank you, sir. If it may please the court, what I'd like to do is start out, unless the court has a better order, and just take the issues as they arise in the brief. That would, of course, first start with the jurisdictional issue. I realize this is somewhat of a unique issue, and it's brought about in many cases because, frankly, some of the statutes did not catch up with the massive reserve mobilizations of the last decade. And it's not an issue of first impression. It's something that we face, and this court has faced once before an extraordinary writ in U.S. versus Toro. But the first duty of any court is to establish jurisdiction. There's a sua sponte requirement. Every court in the land, and especially when you're dealing with a limited jurisdiction court such as a court-martial, the court has to make sure that it has jurisdiction. Three requirements: subject matter jurisdiction, which at this point we're going to concede, personal jurisdiction, and a properly convened court-martial. It's the area of personal jurisdiction that we have the problem and why we raised this issue. The statutes allow for certain different eventualities, different sections of the statute. Section 12301D, in which the major was recalled, is set aside in the Defense Appropriations Act every year, and I think I quoted it in the reply brief, for reserve management purposes. And it refers to Section 12 U.S.C. 310A, which requires it to go into organizing, administering, recruiting, instructing, or training the reserve components. Now, in some cases, some provisions of these Appropriations Act are not mandatory. They're you send the money, but if the department has to move them around, that's fine. But in this case, this Appropriations Act, which was passed by Congress, was signed by the President, has the force of law, limits this particular budget line item to active duty for special work.
Well, counsel, before we get there, don't we have to determine whether it was that statute that was the recall authority?
Yes, sir. On the original brief, I put in a copy of the orders, and you'll see under the authority section, I'm sorry, I don't remember the lock number offhand, that it was the 10 U.S.C. 12301D.
Well, but that was cited on the Form 938, but didn't the convening authority cite Section 802?
Yes, sir. However, that gives him the subject matter. That gives him the right, or he's exercising a right to do the recall. The actual recall itself was the 10 U.S.C. 12301D. And it's like if you're going to put it in Air Force terms, you'll have to excuse me, I'm Navy, so I may mess up a couple of things, but if you're going to do a strafing attack with an A-10, look at the rules of engagement. Everybody says, yes, it's go ahead and do the strafing. If you don't have any bullets in the gun, it's still not effective. And our point is 12301D is the bullets in the gun. You have to recall them properly. You can't just say, I can recall them. You can't talk hypothetically. In the end, you've got to go to the right statute. And otherwise, in this case, and with all due respect to the Air Force, you're actually breaking the law, by using funds that are intended for another purpose and are specified in the Act for another purpose. So I think, hopefully I'm answering your question here. I think when we look at the Article 2 and the Article 3, they establish the subject matter jurisdiction, the hypothetical jurisdiction, and the potential to recall. It still has to be executed by 938. Is that responsive to your question, sir?
It is, but even if we were to agree with you that 12301 was the statute under which he was recalled?
Yes, sir.
If we consider your argument that there is no authority to use that statute for this purpose.
That's correct.
Where does your client get a personal benefit from that, or a personal standing to attack that, if as I take your argument, it's a financial management type argument. It's a violation of the Anti-Deficiency Act or some other regulation.
Actually, that's not the primary thrust of the argument. It's just, it's more of a secondary issue. What I'm saying is putting that forward to illustrate the fact that that is not proper, proper statute to use, or actually the proper subsection of the standard, of the, that particular standards. I am tongue-tied today. I'm sorry. That particular statute, So again, I think the point is, they can recall him, and in fact, they can redo a rehearing. They just have to use the correct statute, and if they don't do that, you just don't get the personal jurisdiction. Now, I know the government, in their supplemental authority, talked about the Cali case, and I think it was the Hout case. Got a different situation there. Those were people that were on active duty, retained on active duty, and then 10 U.S. 1168 comes into play. Or 1168, once you're on active duty, they got you. And until you get a DD-214 or something else which releases you from active duty or a substantial portion of your pay, you're on active duty. So I retired a long time ago in 1994. Had I not gotten a DD-214, I would have still been expected to report to work, even though I had my 20 years, actually it was 22, for retirement purposes. Here, we're doing something different. We're initiating active duty. We're not retaining somebody on active duty. And I think that's why the Cali case and the Howe cases are distinguishable.
So if I'm correctly understanding your argument that 802, are you saying 802 provides subject matter jurisdiction?
That's correct.
Then what would be the appropriate recall mechanism for your client under the facts of the case?
I think 12301A would probably have been more appropriate. But that's an opinion. I don't want to come and get in the business of telling the Air Force how to do their job. I just try to get in the business when I think they've done it wrong.
Well, you would concede, I take it, that there is a mechanism by which he could have been recalled.
Yes, no question. We have said that all along.
Well,
and they can recall him again.
Count, and the reason I'm asking the question is, if it is your view that 12301A would have been the appropriate mechanism, what's the difference in language that leads you to subsection A instead of subsection D?
You're asking me to remember that statute, and I can't, but as I remember it, it's the term consent of the accused, okay, which I don't believe is in subsection A.
So now, you're saying the appellant did not consent to being recalled to active duty?
The appellant did not consent. He was given a set of orders and said, be there.
Did he give back the pay and allowance that he received for the period that he was on active duty?
No, he did not.
Did he make any objection at the court-martial?
Not that I know of. I could not find that in the record.
Did he write a letter to any Air Force officials saying he did not consent to coming back on Air Force duty?
Your Honor, he's a doctor, not a lawyer. He didn't really know a thing about jurisdiction. Let's face it, it's a fairly new area. But here is what happens when you're requesting orders as a reservist, and you all probably know this. You request the orders. You come and say, either, hey, Joe, I need some mandates, or here's a form I fill out that I want to go on this UTA, or whatever. Okay, and that is where you get consent. Because at that
well, that's
point,
your proffer to this court. Is there anything in the record to demonstrate that that's how consent is supposed to be obtained?
I can only tell you, in my last, it is a proffer, sir, yes. In my last life, I ran a Navy Marine Corps Reserve Center, so somewhat familiar with the process that's required, but it's you don't, and it makes sense when you think about it, because these guys are disciplined, they've got jobs they have to coordinate, they have family issues, and then if they're going to spend time to go on the UTA, go ADSW, or even the AT, something has to be coordinated all around that, so they have to look at their schedule and then say, yes, I want my 2 weeks AT. And, you know, it brings up a very good point when you talk about subject matter and personal jurisdiction. In the reserves, everyone is required to do one annual training a year, okay? And that's a requirement. That's kind of like Article 2. But until you put in that request and get your AT orders, you don't actually go on it. So, and that will be personal jurisdiction. So even though the law says and the policies say you have to do that 2 weeks, UCMJ jurisdiction does not attach. So you actually request and execute those orders. And that may not be the best analogy in the world, but I think it is appropriate. Is that responsive to your question, sir?
It is, I have a separate question on what's our standard of review here. This was not raised at trial.
It was not. Plain error.
The government is arguing some form of a waiver-type argument. You cite the unpublished Navy Marine Corps case of Burgess in
yes.
partial response for the proposition that under Article 66, our broad authority under that statute, that we have a sua sponte responsibility to consider the issue of in personam jurisdiction. Is that your argument?
That's part of it, sir. Every court has a requirement to establish their own jurisdiction. And yes, I think there is a sua sponte requirement on the military judge to do that. Problem, and again, part of the problem is a lot of this is developing, you know, from our experiences of the last decade. You know, we never did this before. In many cases, the laws, the JTRs, the whatever, have not really been updated. But, yes, I think they have a requirement to do that. The second thing that I think...
Mr. Wells, I'm going to interrupt you here for a second. You're pacing to either side of the podium, and although we have no trouble hearing you here at the bench, that your words are not going to be recorded, which typically we post these. So if you can make sure you stay in front of the microphone.
My apologies, Your Honor. One of the bad things, I guess, about practicing law in civilian life is you have a tendency to wander. So I drive my wife crazy. Sometimes she wants to just chain me to something, but it's a bad habit. Gus came from walking the decks of the ships many times, many years ago.
And I'll assure you that we've been able to hear your comments, just that for the recording that we post later, I'm not sure that all your comments were recorded as you stepped away from the microphone.
Yes, sir. Your Honors, and unfortunately, I kind of lost my train of thought.
That's
there.
Fine. We were discussing standard review. You pretty much answered that. The only point I'd make on your citation to the Burgess case, the unpublished Navy Marine Corps case, is that lengthy citation that you quoted from that case actually comes from a concurring opinion in the case, which you did not note in your brief. So I'm not sure what precedential value that holds, but you've answered my question on the
standard
review.
Yes, sir. It's an unpublished case. It has no only persuasive authority anyhow. I think we put it in there mostly for the analysis. I did want to address the issue of Toro, which this court, and it's probably a different panel, had discussed, and that was a very similar 12301D issue. Came up on an extraordinary writ, and we did protect the issue at trial. There's no question on that. The court at that point said, well, we consider that an administrative error rather than constitutional magnitude or anything to grant extraordinary writ on. And Toro will not come back up to you since, you know, we're below the Article 66 threshold on it. But I would call the court's attention to U.S. versus Warden, okay, which basically says, you keep making an administrative error, then it becomes more than, you can't just dismiss this administrative error anymore.
Now, well, counsel, didn't, even if we were to agree that an administrative error occurred in this case, didn't it occur before we decided Toro?
It did.
So the government arguably would not have been on notice from Toro that there was an administrative error in this case.
Well, Your Honor, that's a good point, except for it's happening all over the Air Force.
What evidence do we have of that?
Well, we've got Toro, the other case, and I think I may have referenced in Toro the other case of Lanier. There was no conviction, no final conviction, so you know it's you can't appeal an acquittal, thank God. So, you know, as you look at this, Your Honors, one of the things, because you're right, I can't give you examples. This is the third case I know of, but in your decision, you can certainly say, from here on out, that will never happen, and that will have some precedential value. I personally think that Major O'Connor should get the benefit of the doubt on this because, I mean, gosh, you know, you can retry him. But, you know, if you don't do that, you could certainly set the bench line from now and say, we can't use 12301D without the consent of the accused anymore. And if Your Honors will allow, I'd like to move into the next one, which is the Article 32. Unless you have any more questions. Okay. This, again, is a plain error situation. Did an error occur? Sure. MRA 301F applies to Article 32s by RCM 405. Okay. Is that plain and obvious? Certainly.
Anybody who reads the RCMs or reads the MCM knows that is the case. Is there prejudice to the accused? When you publish the fact to a finder of fact, or in this case a finder of probable cause, that somebody has invoked their rights, yes, under all our constitutional law, that is prejudicial.
Now, Counselor, if we take that legal concept that you're urging on us, what would you say would be the right outcome in a case where there's a litigated motion to suppress at trial, the basis being an Article 31 violation? The trial judge denies the motion to suppress, and then the accused thereafter goes on to be tried by a bench trial, judge sitting alone. Is the judge required to recuse him or herself in that scenario?
I don't think he's required to. If I was defense counsel, depending on all the dynamics of the situation, I may make a motion for him to recuse.
And what would the basis be?
And the basis would be the fact that he's already seen evidence that's prejudicial, and now he's going to trial. Oh, wait a minute, you said deny motion. I'm sorry.
But isn't the case law, the point I'm getting to is, isn't our case law and the Supreme Court's case law very clear that a judge is not tainted by information he or she receives in their judicial capacity?
I'm sorry, sir. I see where you're going now. And actually, that's what I was going to get to, because the government raised that in their brief. Okay, first off, the IO is not a judge. He's not, in most cases, has not been to judge a school, not got the advanced training. But let's assume for a moment that he's going to make that same decision that a military judge would. It still goes, and this is something government did not address, it still goes to the convening authority.
It does? That we know that those six words in that 270-page OSI report were seen by the convening authority.
We know it wasn't, Your Honor.
What's the evidence that the convening authority saw that?
Interestingly enough, Judge, there's none. But I would hope and assume that a convening authority would thoroughly review everything.
Is the SJA required to present all attachments to the IO report to the convening authority?
It was submitted as an exhibit, so yes, sir, I believe they are. But
authority says that the SJA has to attach every attachment to an IO report to the convening authority?
The attachments are part of the IO report. I believe that the IO report has to go up. But just for a second, let's say that that's a question of fact right now. Who has the burden on proving that there was no harm? Government has, because we're talking plain error, the government has the burden, since we've shown a constitutional issue, since...
How have you shown a constitutional issue? You've shown that there was a reference to the accused invocation of his right to counsel.
That's correct.
In an attachment to the IO report.
That's
how
correct.
Does that rise to the level of a constitutional violation?
Because the fact that he invoked his rights was disclosed.
And is that what case stands for the proposition that that is per se a constitutional violation?
At Article 32, probably none. At court-martial or in a trial, cited a number of them in the briefs.
Well, you said Griffin versus Counsel,
that information was never introduced at trial, though, correct?
I'm sorry?
That information that he invoked his right to counsel was never introduced at trial.
Sorry, Your Honor, I didn't do the trial, but yes, it was not introduced.
It was not introduced at trial. So it's only at the 32 stage that you're concerned about this?
32 and the referral stage.
Now, how do you distinguish United States versus Davis and United States versus Mikkel, which talks about that the time to challenge the 32 is at the trial, and that it's different when at appellate level, when we look at the rights afforded the accused at trial, supersede those which were the underlying 32. Where is the error at his court-martial from evidence that was not introduced at the court-martial?
The error is in the pre-court process, in the referral process, or you can say at the 32, but I think the biggest emphasis should be on the referral process.
So the error was only at the pre-court process?
That's correct.
No error at the court-martial on this issue?
Correct. Okay. However, if the referral was improper or done because of tainted evidence or whatever, okay, then the court-martial should never have come into being. Now, again, Judge, I didn't do the trial, so... You know, these issues were not necessarily, these were issues that I would have raised, but I wasn't there. And I'm not knocking the other counsel. I think they did a fantastic job. But, you know, it is difficult. And I see I've got to move on very fast. If you give me just a second. I still say under the plain error, the burden has shifted to the government, and they have to show no prejudice beyond a reasonable doubt. Okay. The instruction dealing with the mistake of fact, I think that's very important. And it's a required instruction when some evidence shows that, in fact, instruction should be given. In this particular case, there was evidence from the major himself who testified he did not know the girl was enlisted. Okay. The girl herself kind of supports that, corroborates it a bit when she made the comment, "You have just bad word, a staff sergeant."
Why is mistake of fact as to rank an affirmative defense in this case? Is it really an affirmative defense, or is it simply an element of the offense that he must know that she was an enlisted person?
Well, it's an interesting question. But then you come out onto the, I'm almost out of time, but it's an article, fraternization is Article 92, published instruction, and part of it is officer enlisted. If two majors had gotten together for one night stand, okay, we wouldn't be here today. But now we had a major and a staff sergeant. So the question was, did he know she was a staff sergeant? The instruction should have been given, and the members would have the choice of giving the testimony and so on and so forth the weight that it deserved, or the weight they felt it deserved. But here, by not giving the instruction, we did prejudice the accused. And again, the best evidence of that, and it kind of is on all fours with the DiPaolo case, is that where the instruction was given, he was acquitted. Where the instruction was not given, he was convicted. And if I may reserve the balance of my time.
You may, but when we come back in rebuttal, I'd like to readdress this issue of why you think it's an affirmative defense here rather than an element of the offense of fraternization.
And counsel, actually, I'd like to, let's close out this issue before we move to the other side. So,
fair enough. Isn't an affirmative defense normally a matter that, although the elements of the offense have been met, it absolves the accused of criminal responsibility? Like mistake of fact as to consent in an Article 120 case. The elements of the offense are met, but nonetheless, because the accused had a mistake of fact as to consent, the criminal responsibility does not attach. That's not the case here, is it? Isn't it just an element of the offense that he must know that she was an enlisted person?
Well, actually, it's questionable whether that was even an element of an offense, and I don't have the charge sheet in front of me.
Is that not the third element of the offense of fraternization, that the accused must know that the other person was an enlisted person?
Fraternization, I do not believe.
I'll give you a hint. The answer is yes.
Okay.
It is. So why is that an affirmative defense?
Because if he thought or didn't realize that she was an enlisted person, there was no violation. As I said, if two majors get together for one night stand, there's no violation. There's no fraternization. So, and actually, it's a complete defense because it completely negates the thrust of the statute. The statute, as I remember it, says officer and enlisted. Okay, says nothing about knowledge. So that's where the mistake of fact defense would come in. Is that responsive, sir?
I've had enough on that. Thank you.
Okay.
I do want to ask you one question with the mistake of fact. Assuming it does exist, it would have to be both honest and reasonable, correct?
Yes.
Where in the record is there some evidence that his mistake of fact would have been reasonable?
Well, Your Honor, that's really for the trier of fact to determine. We're talking about giving instruction
here. Point you then to the case of United States versus Gurney, which this court has recently decided, a published decision, in which we examined the record and said there was no evidence in the record of the reasonableness of the mistake. How would you distinguish Gurney from this case in terms of any evidence that his mistake of fact was reasonable?
Because there is some evidence. And that's the standard. And Gurney there was no evidence. But here we had a situation of people that were together for a long time, but they were riding separate areas of the plane in a very dark airplane, it's dark most of the time, flying over from the United States to Europe. Then everybody tired, everybody going down, drinking beer, not really paying attention. And in the initial stages, those two didn't talk that much. They talked some, but not that much. We've also got a reservist and a doc who's not really up to speed on military courtesies and ranks. Some of the doctors I dealt with in the military didn't realize what their own rank was.
Is there any evidence in the record here that this major did not know the basic rank structure of the Air Force, and that a person who was in uniform with him on this flight, assumably wearing rank, and then the evidence in the record being that they had some discussion for a lengthy period of time in building while they're both in uniform, still had no evidence, had no information presented to him as to her rank?
There is evidence that he did not know she was enlisted. That evidence came from him, and to some extent when she made her comment, staff sergeant comment, it came from her. But even if it doesn't come from her, if the man gets on stand under oath and says, I didn't know she was enlisted until afterwards, okay, that goes to that should generate the instruction. Now, how much weight a member of the court would give that, that's a different story. And they may have given it no weight at all for the very reasons you point out. I don't know. But then they may have given it some weight, too. Again, the folks that were on in the members' box, they're experienced Air Force officers. They probably dealt with reserves before. They would make that choice on how much weight to give it. But we still have to give the instruction. It's like with any other piece of evidence. It may be very unreliable evidence, but if it meets the basic standards of relevancy, it's not a 403 problem, we bring it in. And then we trust the members to give it the weight. In this particular case, we took the weight, the weighing process away from the members, from the triers of fact, because we didn't give the right instruction. Is that responsive, sir?
It is.
Okay. I'm not sure how much time I have left, but perhaps you'd be generous and give me a few extra minutes, but if I can reserve the balance, I would certainly appreciate it.
You may. Captain Steer, are you ready?
Yes, thank you.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, I am Captain Meredith Steer, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Catherine Oler, we represent the United States in this case. Personal jurisdiction existed over appellant because he was ordered to active duty pursuant to 10 U.S.C. Section 802. Appellant waived any defect in his Article 32 investigation. The military judge appropriately instructed the members based on the law, and appellant's conviction for fraternization is legally and factually sufficient. First, appellant was ordered to active duty for the court-martial proceedings pursuant to 10 U.S.C. Section 802, and therefore, personal jurisdiction existed over him during the court-martial.
Counsel, his orders don't cite that section, do they? They, in fact, cite 12301D?
The actual orders that the Air Force form do indeed cite the wrong statute, 10 U.S.C. 12301D.
So then how do we determine that he was called to active duty under 802, as you argue?
When you look at the convening authorities memorandum and his request to the Secretary of the Air Force, he cites the appropriate statute, 10 U.S.C. Section 802. And it was simply an administrative error by the certifying official, a civilian, Mr. Rodney Schaefer, I believe, who cited to the inappropriate statute. But under the convening authorities' intent and the Air Force officials, those officials who were actually the ones responsible for bringing appellant back onto active duty, he was ordered pursuant to the appropriate statute, Section 802.
How do we know that was an administrative error? I understand that the memo, initial memo, indicates Article 2 for the authority. How do we know that something didn't change? How do we know that wasn't a deliberate decision by Air Force officials to cite that other provision?
Well, I don't think you have any evidence in the record, Your Honor, that that was the case. What you have is almost the exact same situation as you did in U.S. v. Toro, where, again, the Air Force officials wrote the appropriate memorandums, the convening authority and the Secretary of the Air Force cited to 10 U.S.C. Section 802, and then this court held in Toro that there was an administrative error by the individuals who typed up the actual forms when they cited to 10 U.S.C. Section 12301.
Let's assume it is an administrative error. As you noted, this is at least the second time that this has happened in the course of the last year, year and a half or so. Has the Air Force institutionally the Appellate Government Division done anything to put out the word to try and avoid future issues like this?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of any type of memorandum that's gone out to the Air Force, but appellant cited U.S. v. Warden is saying that that case stands for the proposition that administrative errors can be fixed by an opinion from this court. U.S. v. Warden dealt with an entirely different set of facts and a different circumstance where individuals who were given a partial forfeiture sentence were having that applied against both their forfeiture and their allowances. And that was strictly incorrect according to the manual for court-martial. So in Warden, the court was just admonishing the fact that legal offices around the Air Force were not paying attention to the manual for court-martial. In this case, we're talking about an administrative error by a certifying official in the Air Force Reserve Command, who's on the regular business of completing orders that are directed to him. That individual is not aware of the intricacies of the statutes, but the General Court-Martial Convening Authority and the Secretary of the Air Force were, and they were the ones who ordered appellant back to active duty in this case.
How can we make that leap, though? Because what you just argued is the person who generates the orders as his or her regular course of business, they do this every day. I think you would agree that convening authorities do not routinely order reservists recalled to active duty, nor does the secretary. They may do it occasionally, but they're not certainly doing it all day, every day. Why should we not conclude that it was the reserve order issuing official who does this daily that got it right?
Because it's the convening authority who's the one who's actually ordering somebody back to active duty for court-martial purposes, not a civilian who's doing the actual money handling of things. It's the convening authority who's making the decision as to whether Major O'Connor should be court-martialed for the offenses that he was allegedly committed.
So, but if those orders, that Air Force Form 938, if that document had not been generated, would you agree that Major O'Connor would not have been recalled to active duty?
No, Your Honor.
It was the 938 itself that recalled him, was it not?
No, Your Honor. I would say that it's the memorandum from the General Court-Martial Convening Authority that actually ordered him back onto active duty.
Then what would be the purpose of generating the 938?
To provide the fund site and the necessary paperwork to Major O'Connor, but the actual authority to bring him back onto active duty is the memorandum from the General Court-Martial Convening Authority.
Okay, maybe you chose your word advisedly, maybe not. Is there not a distinction between the authority to recall someone and the actual execution of that recall? For example, am I hearing you say that the convening authority's memorandum provided the authority for the Air Force Reserve officials to issue the 938, but it's the 938 that affected the recall and brought him on active duty?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's just like this court said in U.S. v. Toro. It's the intent of the Air Force officials and those with that authority, the General Court-Martial Convening Authority, that carries the day. It's not an administrative error by those who are actually putting out the orders that affect whether appellant was on active duty for the court-martial purposes. Moreover, there's no evidence in the record that appellant didn't consent to jurisdiction in this case. There's absolutely no evidence in the record that he ever protested his being recalled back to active duty. So he personally appeared.
Counsel, is that the burden on the appellant, or is that the burden on the government? In terms of, does the government have to prove that there was consent, or does the appellant have to prove that he did not consent?
It appears that appellant would have to prove that he did not consent, that he would have to point to something to show that he did not consent. But in this case, the United States can prove that he did consent by his appearing at the Article 32 hearing. There's absolutely no evidence that he ever appeared in civilian clothes. It appears that he came to all the proceedings in uniform, He didn't object to being at the Article 32 hearing. His counsel didn't file any objections on his behalf. At the trial, he interacted with the military judge. He got up on the stand and he testified, and not once did he say, I don't consent to being here on active duty. He completed those orders that were provided to them, provided to him, and he signed them. And he was paid and accepted pay for each of the periods covered by those orders. In addition, if you look at the record at 546 to 47, the military judge put on the record that there was jurisdiction over appellant at the time that he committed the offenses. That would have been an appropriate time to perhaps say, there might have been jurisdiction at that point, but I'm contesting jurisdiction right now. And appellant did not do that.
So are you arguing that the standard of review here is plain error? Are you arguing waiver? Are you simply arguing that the record should have been built at trial?
Your Honor, what I'm arguing is that although appellant can raise jurisdiction for the first time on appeal, and that's recognized by the case law, and that's a question that this court can look at de novo, the case law also seems to suggest that the court is willing to find consent to jurisdiction, especially in a case where you have the General Court-Martial Convening Authority and the Secretary of the Air Force expressing their intent to recall appellant to active duty for the court-martial purposes. So the case law seems to suggest that if you can't point to something that shows that you didn't consent, the courts are forgiving of that and saying it appears that you have consented. Additionally, Your Honor, I apologize. I lost my place there. But in this case, appellant was properly recalled to active duty pursuant to 10 U.S.C. Section 802. The United States is simply also arguing that not only was he properly recalled, he also consented to that jurisdiction by not objecting it at any point. Turning to the next issue, appellant has waived any defect in the Article 32 hearing in this case. He has provided absolutely no case law to support his position that the investigating officer cannot receive the report of investigation prior to holding the Article 32 hearing to ensure that all of the appropriate evidence is presented during the Article 32 hearing.
Well, I'm not sure that's exactly his argument, counsel. I think the argument is that it was considered during the Article 32.
And there's absolutely no evidence that the investigating officer considered the fact that appellant first made a verbal statement to OSI, and then after making that verbal statement, decided to invoke his rights.
Wasn't that in evidence before the investigating officer?
It was a note in the 200-some page ROI that was given to the investigating officer.
Okay, so the answer is yes, it was in evidence before the investigating officer.
Yes, Your Honor.
How do we know that he did not consider it?
There's absolutely no mention of this in the Article 32 report. What is mentioned is what appellant asserted to OSI when he made that verbal statement, as well as what he asserted during an unsworn statement during the Article 32, and again what he asserted in writing in an unsworn statement after the Article 32. That is what you have in the Article 32 report. RCM 905B1 states that objections based on defects in referral, investigation, or forwarding of charges must be made prior to entry of a plea. And RCM 905E states that a failure by a party to raise objections under subsection B shall constitute waiver. There was absolutely no objection to the Article 32 hearing in this case, which was a thorough and impartial review of the evidence and the recommendation to go to trial in this case. Even entertaining...
Should we presume that the convening authority saw this six-line or six-word statement? In other words, is the convening authority required to be provided with the Article 32 report and all attachments?
Your Honor, there's nothing in the record to suggest that the convening authority did not see the entire Article 32 report and all of its exhibits, but there's also nothing in the record to suggest that the convening authority considered this. I think we would maybe be in a different position, and probably this would have been objected to at trial had the investigating officer said, because appellant eventually invoked his right to counsel, I believe he's guilty and this case should go forward. That didn't happen here, and to assume that the convening authority made his decision to go forward to trial based off of that, it's illogical. And even entertaining appellant's position and shifting this to a plain air analysis, appellant cannot demonstrate that there is an impact to a substantial right. He received a fair trial. He got up and he testified before the members, and they heard all of the evidence in the case. And not once during the trial was any mention made of the fact that he initially invoked his rights during an interview with OSI. Turning then to the fourth assignment of error and the third issue before the court today, the military judge appropriately instructed the members based on the law. Mistake of fact is not an affirmative defense to fraternization. Appellant has provided you absolutely no case law because no case law exists that says, published or unpublished, mistake of fact is to rank as a defense, an affirmative defense to fraternization. One of the elements that the military judge instructed the members on and the members had to find beyond a reasonable doubt was that appellant knew that Staff Sergeant J.K. was enlisted. And they found that. They found him guilty, and that was, beyond a reasonable doubt, their finding. He knew. And so any idea that the military judge should have instructed them on appellant's mistaken belief, apparently, that she was not enlisted was unnecessary because the judge followed the law and instructed the members. Appellant took the stand. He testified in one line during his direct. He said in one line, he was asked by trial defense counsel, did you know that Staff Sergeant J.K. was enlisted? And he said no. That's it during his direct. He didn't explain why. And considering in the entire context of all the evidence that came out, you can see why this was so unreasonable on his part. He was on a training mission with 20 individuals from his unit. He's a flight doctor and she's a flight tech, a med tech. Taking this out of the circumstances of Major O'Connor's case and putting this in a different situation, imagine a group of 20 JAGs and paralegals at a conference together all day in uniform. It would be completely unreasonable to think that the JAGs or the officers in the room wouldn't know who the enlisted were and vice versa. More than that, appellant was going back into the back of the plane because he did not have a duty such as piloting the aircraft or checking the systems controls, so he was free to roam about the plane and actually did so. Then this group got on a bus and rode to Lodge's Field together. Then they waited for 3 to 4 hours to check in, and they were all in uniform in a small lobby. And during that time, appellant actually had a conversation with Staff Sergeant J.K., yet he says that he didn't know that she was enlisted. This might be a different case had appellant said that he thought that she was an officer or thought that she was a civilian. But again, if you go back to the record of his direct exam, he does not explain why or how he was somehow mistaken about her rank.
Why does he need to do that? Isn't it sufficient to raise the issue for him simply to say, I didn't know?
Your Honor, I don't believe so. I believe that there has to be more than that to even raise this as a possibility.
Well, what does some evidence mean then? What you're saying certainly goes to the factual sufficiency of the conviction, but when we talk about, and presuming that this is an affirmative defense, presuming that, you know, in the right context it should be instructed upon, why is there not some evidence here of the accused belief that she was not an enlisted person?
Well, I think the fact that trial defense counsel did not ask for a mistake of fact instruction shows you that there was not at least some evidence. And again, you have to put this back into the context of, it's not like he met this individual out at a nightclub that evening and brought her back to his room. And then it might be more believable that there is some evidence that he didn't know that she was enlisted.
But isn't that a factual matter for the members to decide?
It is, Your Honor.
So I think going to Judge Weber's question, how much evidence, in your view, is some evidence in this case? What more would we have required of the trial judge to hear before he would have instructed if this were an affirmative defense? Are you saying that the Major O'Connor would have had to have explained the basis for his belief to have raised some evidence?
Your Honor, I believe that the military judge would have had to have received a little bit more evidence than I just didn't know. It would have to be something to where the military judge could find that the members could even find that this would be an issue for their consideration.
Was there any evidence that there were any civilians on this mission?
There was not, Your Honor.
So we can infer then, I think, from the record that the mission was all officer and enlisted, correct?
That's what I take from the record, Your Honor.
And is it a fair assumption from the record that Major O'Connor knew who all the officers were because he was back and forth to the flight deck?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Counsel, would you concede, if mistake of fact is an issue, requires both some evidence of honest and some evidence of reasonableness as well, when we look at some evidence, we look at whether the evidence has been introduced regardless of its source and its credibility. Isn't his statement that I didn't know she was enlisted, isn't that some evidence that he had an honest mistake of fact? Not whether you find it persuasive or whether the members would have found it persuasive, but isn't that some evidence of an honest...
Your Honor, I don't believe it's some evidence under the circumstances in this case. Were this a situation where there had been civilians around, or were this a situation where he had just met her off base that day, that might be some evidence. But under the circumstances here, I don't believe it's some evidence. But even if you find that it is some evidence, it wasn't reasonable given the rest of the circumstances that I've described. And Your Honor, I also want to point out, even though the bench book is not a binding authority on any military judge, the bench book makes absolutely no mention of even considering a mistake of fact instruction in this case. Versus if you look at other sections of the bench book where knowledge would be an element, knowledge of a fact, it mentions looking at mistake of fact or even gives standard instructions that the military judge might want to look at. For example, in U.S. v. McDonald, when the court was looking at receiving stolen property, and one of the things that the individual needed to know there was whether the property was in fact stolen. If you actually look at the bench book for receiving stolen property, it gives standard instructions there. The same for assault on a commissioned officer. If you look at the bench book, it actually says in the notes at the bottom, consider giving an instruction on mistake of fact. Here in the bench book, there's nothing to suggest that the military judge should have sua sponte known to instruct the members on this. Moreover, the trial defense counsel submitted their own written request for instructions, including mistake of fact as to consent on the sexual assault and several other tailored instructions. Trial defense counsel didn't ask for an instruction in this case. So that's evidence to suggest that nobody in this case saw that as something that the military judge should be instructing on. And therefore, it was not something that was obvious, plain and obvious to the military judge or trial defense counsel. Moving on to the fourth issue, appellant's conviction for fraternization is both legally and factually sufficient. And unless you have any specific questions on this issue, the United States rests on our brief.
I do have one question on this issue. In the brief, the government states that one of the pieces of evidence that supports a finding of legal and factual sufficiency on this element, the prejudicial good order and discipline element, is Staff Sergeant J.K.'s feeling that she was raped after the incident. How does that support an element of or a finding of prejudicial good order and discipline, particularly when the appellant was acquitted of this charge?
Your Honor, the fact that Staff Sergeant J.K. felt like she was raped, I think the point of the brief there was that it affected her emotional readiness. And when you're looking at conduct that's prejudicial to good order and discipline, this was a training mission. Staff Sergeant J.K. was expected to be able to perform her duties, and that affected her ability to perform her duties and her military readiness. I believe that's the point of the brief, Your Honor.
Is it... And you could imagine other situations not rising to the level of a perceived rape that also could impact a person's feeling like they were ready for the mission. You know, perhaps their interaction after the sexual act does not go well, or perhaps there's, you know, there are emotional feelings that arise from both parties or something like that. I mean, to what extent is the enlisted person's feelings about what has just transpired play into this element of prejudicial to good order and discipline?
Well, Your Honor, all of those feelings are relevant. So regardless of whether Staff Sergeant J.K. is upset about her interactions with the appellant after the sexual activity or she felt like she was raped, she started cutting herself. All of that goes to whether this is prejudicial to good order and discipline, and it's partly the reason why you have the offense of fraternization, to prevent this very situation, because Staff Sergeant J.K. is expected to follow the orders of the officers above her, and as she's feeling either rejected or angry or like she's been raped by appellant, that affects her military readiness, and that goes to prejudice to good order and discipline.
And I guess that's my question. None of those reactions after the sexual act here are unique to an officer-enlisted interaction. I mean, she could have felt this exact same way had she had an encounter with a fellow staff sergeant or with a civilian or whatever. I mean, do those you know, impacts upon her need to be specific to an officer-enlisted interaction?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, when you're talking about the offense of fraternization, they do. The military has chosen to criminalize this, and her reactions, whether they might have been the same with another enlisted or a civilian, that's not a crime. But in this case, it is a crime, and the appellant is the one who was should have been aware of the offenses under the UCMJ, and in fact he testified that he knew it was not okay to have sex with enlisted members, and appellant violated the UCMJ by having sex with Staff Sergeant JK. But there's other evidence in the record beyond the feelings of Staff Sergeant JK that established that there was an impact of good order and discipline. So for example, other enlisted members became aware of what had happened, and they became aware of this during this actual mission. So it wasn't months after the fact when they're back at their home station that they became aware of this. They were aware within hours and days of this interaction while they're still completing the training mission. If there are no other questions, may I briefly conclude?
You may.
Appellant's conviction and sentence should be affirmed because the court-martial had personal jurisdiction over him. He waived any defect in the Article 32 investigation. The military judge properly instructed the members based on the law, and appellant's conviction is both factually and legally sufficient to support his conviction. Thank you.
Please, the court, I'd like to kind of go back in reverse and deal with the last section first, that being the service discrediting conduct. There were a couple issues on that. You know, I've always wondered exactly what prejudicial to good order and discipline is. As a commander, or commanding officer, we call the Navy, I used to say it was anything I wanted it to be. Then I went to law school and found out such things about void versus vague for voidness. Void for vagueness and so on and so forth, and that's perhaps, after looking at it, I'm still not sure what prejudicial good order and discipline is. But, as was pointed out during the appellee's argument, if two majors or two staff sergeants had gotten together, it doesn't matter how she felt. She would have felt the same way if this had happened with a staff sergeant or if she had been a major. Because the issue was she really wasn't that upset about the sex. If you look at the record, it was when he made some pretty stupid comments. That's what got her upset, you know, talking about shaving pubic areas and so on and so forth. Now, I'm not saying I blame her for getting upset, but that had nothing to do with the actual sex or the actual fraternization. And I think that's important to consider because, in the end, what impact did it have on the unit? They finished the mission. Okay, they went back to this big unit. The only possible impact is she said at one time, well, I don't want to have this guy examine me. But if she had been a major and they'd had a one-night stand, that same thing could have occurred. So I really don't think we've met the service discrediting element. Talking about the instruction.
Hold on that issue, are you arguing that there was no evidence presented on the terminal element, or are you simply arguing that there was insufficient evidence presented?
There was insufficient evidence. And to be honest with you, Your Honor, I don't remember anything other than saying that she didn't really want to be examined by this doctor again. That's the only, and that's barely a scintilla.
So is not the trier of fact allowed to consider the surrounding circumstances here? I mean, the fact that this was a small group of people on a training mission, that this happened on a military installation in military lodging, all the other circumstances, how this got, how other people in the unit found out about this, I mean, aren't those all facts that go toward that element?
Well, certainly it does. But, and of course, this comes into the Article 66 authority of the court, where you actually review to make sure everything is correct in law and fact. And I guess we're appealing to the Article 66 authority at this point. The moving on to the instruction issue, I'll call Your Honor's attention to the discussion under RCM, I just have it here. 916? Under RCM 916. And I'm sorry, if you give me a second, I had the place mark and then took it away.
I think you're looking at page 2-113. Discussion under
916J? Yes, sir. That's where I'm going, I believe. Basically, what it says is that it doesn't matter how credible or how incredible the evidence is that's presented that gives rise to the mistake of fact. What is important is the fact that there was some evidence, no matter how credible, that gives rise to the mistake of fact. And we talked a little bit about whether the mistake of fact defense actually arose in this particular case, went back and looked at the elements. Under Article 134, which is where he was charged, knowing that somebody's, for an officer is required to know that somebody was enlisted, or in fact, that the person that he had the improper relationship was enlisted. That would give rise, it's a general intent crime. That's going to give rise to a mistake of fact. When he said, I did not know she was enlisted, that's enough evidence to potentially negate the general intent. Now, again, it's the member's decision, okay? We have to give them the right instructions so that they can bear those in mind when they make that decision. The judge gives the law. Triers of fact make the factual decision, but they also have to apply the law to the facts. And if we fail to give them an instruction to do that, we're putting them at a disadvantage. And they can make a mistake, not through their own fault, but just because they weren't given the right instructions.
Counsel, again, though, in Gurney, this court specified that there has to be some evidence of both prongs of the mistake of fact instruction, both as honest and reasonable. Much like in Gurney, it seems like you keep pointing to his statement, which would be some evidence that it was an honest mistake. But where is there some evidence that it was reasonable?
Well, I think in some ways you have to look at the negative. He was on a C-130, probably already on a C-130, cross-country. He was normally up front. He went back to use the head. He would occasionally prowl around. The airplane at that point in time is dark. Okay, he had never met this girl before. That's all in the record. They land. They separate a bit. They go get some beer. And they start chatting away at the billeting office. Now, as to whether or not how familiar he was whether you have ranks on your flight suit or not, I don't know. To be honest with you, until I read that trial, I didn't realize it, that the Air Force enlisted didn't have their ranks somewhere. I thought they had them on their collars or something.
But, counsel, you're arguing that we should infer or conclude that a field grade officer in the Air Force Reserves doesn't understand military rank insignia?
My experience is what we used to call the Staff Corps. They did not have a great familiarity with a lot of military things. They were primarily a doctor. They were primarily a dentist. And I would suspect it was the same in the Air Force, and especially in the Air Force Reserve, because we have a guy now who's not here every day and seeing it every day. I think it's possible to infer for him to have inferred that because he didn't see any insignia on there, that he just didn't know. Okay. But where this comes into play, Judge, and you ask for some evidence, is she corroborated it. Because when they were having this discussion and so on and so forth, she comes out and says, you just, bad word, a staff sergeant.
Isn't it an equally plausible reading of that, though, that she was simply reminding him that he'd committed a criminal offense?
Well, you could say that, but by the same token, technically she committed one, too, because she knew he was an officer. So I'm not sure... I'm not sure that the fact that he committed a criminal offense is really all that relevant to the sum evidence standard.
Well, no, but I'm looking
to the weight, yes.
But I'm looking at the context in which the statement was made. Wasn't the context of that statement essentially after the encounter had wound down and she had become angered by what he had said, that her retort was that he had just engaged in that conduct with a staff sergeant? Wasn't it more likely or more plausible from the way in which it arose at trial to say that she didn't make the statement informing him that she was a staff sergeant? She made the statement essentially to remind him of what he already knew, which was that he had engaged in inappropriate behavior.
Your Honor, that's a very good point, and that's why we give those points to the trier of the fact. And none of us here at counsel table or yourselves were there. That's why we depend on the trier of the facts to make this decision. So it's not a matter of saying that this was plausible, implausible, or what, because the standard still is some evidence, some reasonability, I agree, that he may have not known that she was enlisted. That's what gives rise to the mistake of fact.
Now, well, and the reason I ask about the context of the interaction was, going back to Senior Judge Mitchell's point, under Gurney, don't we have to look now at the appellate level? Since there was no request at trial, don't we have to look at the reasonableness of the evidence as it came in, or the reasonableness of the belief based on the evidence at trial?
For an Article 66 factual, I would say yes. In determining whether an evidence should have been, an instruction should have been issued, I don't think so, because the court has a sua sponte responsibility to do that. They've got the responsibility to follow what the RCM says. And in this particular case, they didn't do it. And they made it worse because they did it for one charge and not for the other. So it's reasonable for the members to sit out there and infer and say, oh, gee, well, mistake of fact defense doesn't apply in this particular case. And then that, again, goes back to Warden, which I agree had to do with different circumstances, but the theory is still the same and the law is still the same. If you're required to give it and you don't, and especially if you've given it to another specification, that's error. And in this particular case, it's plain error. Same with the Article 32. We've had a situation where there's no doubt that that MRE 301F attached to the Article 32. It's plain as day in the RCM 405. There's no doubt that there was an error. The only question is does it meet the plain error standard? Here we've got something that goes to the core of our Constitution, the invocation of rights. Whether or not the convening authority went through every page with a magnifying glass, I don't know. But the convening authority, the investigating officer, and everybody else operates under a presumption of regularity, that they're going to do their job. And part of that job would be to review that Article 32 report as well as the Article 34 advice. And under the presumption of regularity, we have to presume, at least at this point, that he did see that particular item. And again, Your Honors, this was an easy one. That's all they had to do was redact it. You know, just draw a line through it with a Sharpie pen, and we wouldn't be here on this issue. They failed to do that. They've got to stop failing to do that, because there is real prejudice to the accused. And, you know, as this court exercises its Article 66 powers and finds that there was a violation of law, violation of constitutional issue, can we really say that you can approve the conviction and sentence per Article 66? We would argue that you could not. The jurisdiction, I think we've probably beaten that to death, but the bottom line is that there are two separate steps here. First is to get the theoretical or the subject matter jurisdiction, no question on that. But without that Air Force form ordering him to active duty, he's not on active duty. And you know, and here's why. Because if he doesn't have the piece of paper covering him, he can't get paid. and we are required under the Military Pay Act, 37 U.S.C. 204, to pay somebody on active duty. He can't get insurance protection. If he's driving somewhere and he doesn't have a set of orders and he gets in a car wreck, he's not covered. Or he may be covered, but it takes a major investigation to it, where if he has those orders, there's just no doubt. You know, anybody, in fact, I would say any reservist that travels without a set of orders of some kind is putting themselves at risk. That's why we have the orders. Yes, convening authority had the power to bring him on active duty. No question. Concede that. Concede it from the get-go. But they then have to bring him on active duty, and they have to bring him on active duty in the correct way. If they don't, there's a jurisdictional issue. Supreme Court and Toth,
counsel,
other decisions.
I'm going to note that you've been out of time for a while.
Thank you, sir. I think I've made the point that I was going to make anyhow. Thank you so much, and we appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today.
Counsel, both sides, thank you for your arguments and for your briefs. We will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All rise.